Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This portion of Politics Wednesday talking about U.S. relations with China and Donald Trump's selection of Governor Branstad to be the next U.S. ambassador to China this morning. Trump's transition spokesman Jason Miller confirmed that President-elect Donald Trump plans to offer Iowa Governor Terry Branstad the job of ambassador to China. Of course, Branstad, we've talked about in this show many times over the years, with his extensive ties to China, a personal friendship with the Chinese President Xi Jinping, dating back decades. Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell joins me from our Ames studio. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Ben.
So I understand you've been talking here in Iowa with Branstad's people.
Well, no, I talked to Tim Albrecht, who is a former aide to Governor Branstad. He served as the governor's chief communications person a few years back. And so he when I talked to him, it hadn't been confirmed. It is confirmed now. The Trump people, the transition team, held a conference call with reporters this morning and confirmed it. Up to then, it was the news was broken by unnamed sources with Bloomberg.com last night.
Mm-hmm. So what else can you tell us about the governor? What went into the governor's decision to take this position? We heard yesterday on our news that it was certainly a family decision. Certainly moving to China would need to be a family decision. What else can you tell us about the decision?
Well, I think it's Tim Albrecht, the former aide that I talked to this morning, just called it a capstone to his career. Certainly, he has a experience with China. We'll hear more about that later, probably. But he's long friendship with Xi Jinping, current president of China. He's traveled repeatedly to China on trade missions. So on the conference call this morning, the transition team said it's his experience in public policy, trade, and agriculture that were his selling points.
Mm. Of course, this means another transition, a transition to a new governor here in Iowa at some point, Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds taking the reins of the governorship. Well, what can we look forward to in the coming weeks about that?
Well, it's not clear what the timeline is going to be on that. The appointment, what has to be Governor Branstad's appointment to the ambassadorship, of course, has to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And that won't happen until President-elect Trump is sworn into office. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the governor would wait until then to step down. I'm curious about, and I asked Tim this morning, and he said it's too early to say, but I was curious about whether he would step down before the condition of the state address and the budget address and all of that and just let Kim Reynolds take over, or whether it would follow a more maybe formal line that he's not until he's confirmed by the Senate would he step down as governor. It's too early to say that.
Okay, Joyce, we'll follow that story and look forward to your further reporting on it. Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell, thanks.
Thank you, Ben.
Jonathan Hasid is also with us, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Ben. Good to be here.
Good to have you again talking about China with us as a China expert there. So react to this. You see Governor Branstad as a good fit for this position.
I do. You know, he has, as Joyce Russell just mentioned, he has a lot of experience with China. He apparently first met the Chinese President Xi Jinping in 1985, so, you know, a good long time ago. He goes back and forth between Iowa and China a lot, and clearly he has a lot of high-level contacts among Chinese officials, and, you know, with China importing more and more agricultural goods from the U.S. and from Iowa, it seems like a pretty reasonable pick. And, you know, Terry Branstad is certainly doesn't have a reputation of being an ideological firebrand in any way, and so, you know, it seems like quite a reasonable choice for the incoming Trump administration.
Remind us a little bit more of the Chinese president's connections to Iowa.
Yes, apparently President Xi Jinping first visited Iowa when he was a seed, you know, organization official in China in 1985, quite a junior official, where he stayed in Muscatine for a couple of weeks with a local family. And as he's moved up the ranks, he's come back to visit once in a while. So as vice president, when he came through Iowa, as Chinese vice president, when he came through Iowa last time, he met with his host family in Muscatine. And, you know, he said that his first impression of America was in Iowa. So he, you know, he seems to have strong ties there.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about what's been happening with Donald Trump on the Chinese front in other terms, not just with this pick of Iowa's governor as a U.S. ambassador to China, but the Chinese reacted with concern to Donald Trump's protocol-busting phone call. It was last Friday, I guess, with the leader of Taiwan. That is an island off of mainland China that China considers a rogue province. Now, tell us, first of all, why was that a breach of protocol, and how serious was it?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly a breach of protocol. No U.S. president has spoken directly to a president of Taiwan, at least since the 1970s. And the official position of the United States, expressed in the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, and since then in something called the 1982 Shanghai Communique and other follow-ups, has been that there is only one China, that Taiwan is a part of China, and that, you know, the U.S. does not recognize the government of Taiwan. That is to say, the U.S. does not have official diplomatic representation with Taiwan. There is no American ambassador, for example, to Taiwan. There's an unofficial equivalent, but the rules of the game are that if the U.S. is going to have diplomatic relations with China, the big one, then it has to not have any formal diplomatic relations with little island of Taiwan. And so a lot of people saw President-elect Trump's taking the call of the Taiwanese president Tsai Ing-wen as perhaps signaling an upgrade to relations, perhaps signaling that the United States was prepared to make Taiwan, have formal diplomatic relations again, which certainly would be a very big change in many decades of administrations, both Republican and Democrat.
Mm-hmm. So how are Trump's people explaining this breach of protocol, whether it was sort of unintentional? I mean, that was the first story we heard. Well, got a call, had to take it, right? But
that's
it was really more than that, wasn't it?
It was, yes. So Trump initially, there was a lot of controversy when Trump took this call, and his initial response on Twitter was to put in all caps that she called me. Yes, just implying that it was sort of a spur-of-the-moment thing, that the Taiwanese president just decided on a whim to call the president-elect. Now we're learning that there's been a lot of groundwork laid for this, apparently, for months. Bob Dole, in particular, who now is a consultant in Washington, is taking a lot of credit for he's actually on Taiwan's payroll now to the tune of $25,000 a month, and he's taking credit for essentially setting up this call in advance. And so there seems to be a lot of conflicting evidence coming out of the incoming Trump administration, with Trump himself saying that it was a spur-of-the-moment thing, but everyone else around him saying, no, this was long planned.
Mm-hmm. How are the Chinese reacting, the mainland Chinese,
right,
China that we and the rest of the world recognizes? How have they been reacting?
The first initial response from Foreign Minister Wang, or Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Yi, was quite measured. Basically, the Chinese said that they were disappointed, essentially. But then, since then, they've kind of escalated a little bit. They've launched a formal diplomatic protest, ironically with the Obama administration, of course, since President Obama, of course, is still around. And they've also the official mouthpiece paper of the Communist Party, called People's Daily, over the weekend had a much stronger response, basically saying that if Trump were to sort of turn toward Taiwan, that it would deeply endanger U.S.-China relations. So they essentially seem to be stepping up their response as more evidence emerges that the call was long planned.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I wonder if this choice of Brandstad is likely a known quantity in China, certainly by the Chinese president, if it's likely to reassure the Chinese about the importance of healthy relations with Beijing.
Yeah, I think it might. The Chinese foreign ministry has already released a statement saying that, that they recognize that Governor Brandstad is a long-term friend to Xi Jinping and to China, and that they hope to work fruitfully with him. And so, it may well be that in selecting Governor Brandstad to be ambassador, that the incoming Trump administration is sort of trying to mollify, trying to please the Chinese a little bit right after this somewhat damaging phone call.
Mm-hmm. This is only the latest chapter. Of course, Trump repeatedly attacked China on the campaign trail. And as recently as a pair of tweets from last Sunday, he attacked them over its trade, its currency policies, as well as the way it has staked its territorial claims in the South China Sea. He's threatened to slap tariffs of up to, what, 45% on Chinese goods if Beijing didn't, in his words, behave. What do you make of this? I mean, the Chinese must be scratching their heads, trying to get, well, what is the new world here with Donald Trump at the helm of the U.S.?
Yeah, you know, a lot of us are scratching our heads. One of Trump's big campaign promises was to put a 45% tariff on Chinese goods, which would almost certainly spark a trade war with China. China is America's second largest trading partner after Canada. Unless you count the EU as an entire bloc, in which case China is number three. But, you know, we're talking about a tremendous, enormous volume of trade. And to increase tariffs are essentially taxes. And to increase taxes on Chinese goods by 45%, the Chinese would certainly retaliate in agricultural goods, for example. The whole thing would be very ugly.
And agricultural goods, that would hit Iowa hard.
That would hit Iowa very hard indeed, yes.
Mm-hmm,
So I think Trump is trying to, essentially pressure China to give way on the issues that President Trump wants China to give way on. And he sees the Taiwan issue and perhaps the trade tariff issue as levers to try to move the Chinese. Of course, the Chinese have levers of their own. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
And it's not as if, is it, that Donald Trump is alone here. There are some conservatives in this country hoping to reframe U.S. relations with China, aren't there?
Certainly. A lot of conservatives, not just conservatives, but a lot of conservatives in particular have seen the Obama administration's China policy as being too weak, as giving too much to the Chinese. And so, you know, just with these rhetorical blasts right off the start, even before Trump takes the oath of office, he's signaling that, if there's going to be a fundamental reshaping of relations with China, presumably from Trump's perspective, to the advantage of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the other unconventional part of Donald Trump, President-elect Trump's communication, tweeting here. I'm just curious. I mean, political scientists all over are wondering, is this the new norm? What is your answer to that? Donald Trump has a new form of communication, at least to diplomacy. Is this the new norm that we can expect?
It's, as with everything else about Donald Trump, it's very difficult to say. I mean, clearly he loves Twitter. He loves directly communicating with his followers. And apparently he's been resistant in the past to efforts to take away his Twitter account. Diplomacy is another matter, though. You know, diplomacy involves very sensitive issues conducted by professionals behind closed doors, and if Donald Trump is prepared to make all of U.S. diplomacy available on his Twitter feed, then it's going to be quite a change indeed from the way things have always been done before in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I guess then we don't really know yet how to interpret a tweet from Donald Trump that threatens to slap tariffs of up to 45% on Chinese goods if Beijing didn't behave, a starting point for negotiation purely for domestic consumption, or is it really a part of renegotiating, reframing U.S. relations with China?
I think it's not just for domestic consumption. I think he's trying to send a message to the Chinese saying that, that he's going to be much tougher on China, that he's going to try to pressure the Chinese in ways that previous administrations were unwilling to do. I mean, of course, the Chinese will react to this as it comes out. I mean, the reaction so far has been mostly muted, but if Donald Trump does indeed carry out some of these threats that he's promised, then, you know, the Chinese will react. The Chinese will, you know, engage in their own tariff wars, and the end result would be quite disruptive for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And we have less than a minute, Jonathan. Tell us what you're looking to in the coming weeks before the inauguration of Donald Trump in your area of Chinese expertise.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if he, you know, speaks directly to the Chinese president, not just the Taiwanese president, but to see Jinping himself, whether or not he makes more friendly overtures in areas where, he needs China's help, like on North Korea, for example.
Okay. Always a pleasure to speak with you. Jonathan Hasid, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University, stepping into our Ames studio. Jonathan, thank you very much for your expertise.
Thank you,
Your
Ben.
Insights. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Joining me now, Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Drake University in Des Moines, also Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute of Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Great that you can join us this half hour. Let's pick up where we left off a little bit ago, talking about the news today of Donald Trump's selection of Governor Branstad to be the next U.S. Ambassador to China. We know Branstad has extensive ties to China, a personal friendship with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, that dates back decades. Your reaction to the selection of Branstad? Not a surprise.
Well, a little bit of a surprise. I mean, Terry Branstad is a man who for decades has said how much he loves Iowa, and this is not to suggest that becoming ambassador means he doesn't love Iowa, but this is a man who seemed so comfortable and so thrilled to visit every county every year and just a dyed-in-the-wool Iowan. But, of course, he's been governor for a long time. He clearly wants his lieutenant governor to succeed him. And he has this opportunity to do something brand new. When I first came to Iowa in 1985, that was during Governor Branstad's first term, and people very clearly, when I first got here, I noticed that people used to joke somewhat and say that Governor Branstad's title shouldn't be governor, it should be Minister of Trade and Economic Development. And that's been a focus of his for a long, long time, which is why he's cultivated this relationship with leaders in various countries around the world, but especially China, because China is such a big purchaser of Iowa agricultural products, and that is certainly a significant portion of the Iowa economy. So this gives him a chance to capitalize on that friendship. It also means that Vice President, or I should say President-elect Trump, will have someone at least in office there who will be capable at times, perhaps, of smoothing the ruffled feathers that may occur from time to time.
Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump, that seems ruffled feathers. I don't know if that's his intention. That seems to be what has been happening along the campaign trail in his repeated attacks on China in terms of trade or territorial claims in the South China Sea, or saying he'll slap tariffs of up to 45% on Chinese goods if Beijing didn't respond in a different way. How are you reading the way, I guess you can call them, overtures to China so far by the president-elect?
It's hard to say, because the president-elect is a man, of course, with no governmental or political experience, who has a long history of non-involvement in various policy questions. And at times when he's been involved in policy questions, he said one thing one day and sometimes the opposite the next day, depending upon the particular issue. So it's hard to know what his particular views about China are, except perhaps in terms of a trading partner and the commercial and economic aspects of that. So the question in my mind is, when you have someone who does not have a career of being well informed about particular policy issues, who's talking to him? Who's whispering in his ear? And there's always been a Republican element in the party that has been strong, diehard Taiwan supporters. And this goes back in some ways to the who lost China debate in the late 1940s when Mao Zedong and the communists took over China. And that presupposes the U.S. owned China and lost it, which, of course, is historically false. But that was a nasty, bitter debate. And there have been some unreconstructed folks who still hold to the Taiwanese side of the debate, and they may be the ones whispering in the president-elect's ear.
Okay. Join our conversation. Dennis Goldford is with us on this Politics Wednesday of Drake University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Pete is joining us from West Des Moines. Hi, Pete. What's your question?
Yeah. Well, I just want to make a comment in regards to the fact that if Terry does get the job, that maybe we'll have a better governor in regards to Kim Reynolds. I think she's a little bit more liberal. And at the same time, maybe Terry could be factor in regards to toning down Mr. Trump's rhetoric against China, because China is not a country you want to mess with.
Mm. Okay, Pete, thanks for the observation. So what do we know about Kim Reynolds, the lieutenant governor, current lieutenant governor of Iowa?
When she became, when she was tapped by Governor Branstad to be his running mate in 2010, she had no political profile, an independent political profile of her own at that time. She was, a state senator. She had been a county treasurer or something like that. I don't recall exactly, down in the Osceola area. But she had no real independent political profile. She was purely a creation of Terry Branstad. Now, when she's been at his side constantly, I mean, some people I've heard joke that when he shows up for a press conference, the umbilical cord is quite visible. She's right there at his side, nodding yes and shaking her head no when he denies something. So she's been right there as a faithful companion, faithful supporter, faithful lieutenant governor. When I've heard her speak, either in person or seen video or read accounts of her speeches on her own in various places. A couple times I've wondered whether her appeal, contrary to the listener's call, in some ways, at least in those occasions, was more to what I then called the Sarah Palin wing of the Republican Party than to the more mainstream economic development wing of the Republican Party. And she was a strong supporter of Mr. Trump, always a strong supporter of Terry Branstad. And she's very well positioned to become the next governor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about what the president-elect has been up to in shaping his cabinet. Dennis Goldford of Drake University with us on this edition of River to River. We had yesterday in North Carolina the president-elect Donald Trump named Marine General James Mattis as Secretary of Defense. That was at a rally at Fayetteville. Here he is promising to make America safe again.
Under his leadership, such an important position, we will rebuild our military and alliances, destroy terrorists, face our enemies head on, and make America safe again. It is now my honor and privilege to welcome to the stage your next Secretary of Defense, General Mad Dog Mattis. Thank you.
Thank you, President-elect, for the confidence that you have shown in me. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm grateful for the opportunity to return to our troops, their families, the civilians of the Department of Defense, because I know how committed they are and devoted they are to the defense of our country, the defense of our Constitution. And with our allies strengthened, with our country strengthened, I look forward to being the civilian leader so long as the Congress gives me the waiver and the Senate votes the consent. Thank you very much.
Okay, yesterday in Fayetteville, North Carolina, Donald Trump and the named Marine General James. You heard Donald Trump say his nickname, Mad Dog Mattis, as the next Secretary of Defense. He mentioned the waiver at the end. Dennis Goldford, he's been retired for a few years, but evidently not long enough, according to law.
Right. I believe you have to be retired for 7 years, I think, was the act of Congress from the military if you're going to assume a civilian position like Secretary of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether Congress will give him the waiver, and I'm sure it will. Clearly, Trump loves saying Mad Dog Mattis.
Did you hear what I heard, the crowd barking like mad dogs?
Oh, no, I couldn't hear that.
I think I heard that. Yes, go ahead.
But he's compared Mattis to George Patton. Of course, a lot of us have seen the Patton movie and know of Patton from history. At the same time, we have to remember that Patton could fly off the handle and go his own direction and had to be restrained and controlled at times by Eisenhower, a much more moderating force, much more judicious in terms of how he exercised military power. So Patton had his issues as well, but Mattis clearly represents a more aggressive approach toward dealing with terrorist threats around the world. Now, at the same time, he's been well spoken of by former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta and others, And I believe he actually said, Mattis actually said at one point, or somebody told the story, that he told Trump that no torture, waterboarding doesn't work. I can get more out of a prisoner with a six-pack of beer and a pack of cigarettes than I can with waterboarding. So Mattis is aggressive, but he's respected. He's intelligent. He's well-read. And some more civilian types have a certain comfort level with him. But that's not to deny that there is some concern about the number of ex-military people that Trump is putting into cabinet positions. We don't have a long history of that. And it's concerning to many people because we have this principle of a civilian control of the military acting as a check and a brake on the military, or at least another perspective on the military. And if, in fact, we have former military in charge of current military, there's a certain hothouse atmosphere, as there would be in any profession, when all you hear is from people who are trained similarly.
Mm-hmm. We heard during the campaign from Donald Trump being known as a sort of a non-interventionist around the world, right? Sizing up where the U.S. should intervene in different ways than his predecessors. But at the same time, we're hearing, especially in the selection of General Mattis, a more aggressive posture militarily. How do those two fit together, non-interventionist and at the same time more aggressive?
But there are two different issues there, Ben. What the Bush administration attempted to do was intervene in Iraq on wrong assumptions and so forth, whether accidentally or deliberately, depending upon your point of view and your historical research. But they intervened and they took down Saddam, but then all of a sudden found that with the complete collapse of authority, that they had to engage in precisely what Republicans said they shouldn't be doing, or many Republicans, which is nation building. And I think Trump's opposed to the idea of nation building. I mean, we really don't know much about how other countries work. We have enough trouble understanding how our own country works.
Right.
And in terms of understanding, you know, the arguments between Sunni and Shia Muslims, let alone Sufis, and then you throw in all the various other religious groups and so forth, we don't know anything about that. There's some experts that might, but generally speaking, we don't know much about that at all. So the Trump argument, on the one hand, to neoconservatives who think there's no problem in the world that can't be improved by the application of U.S. military power, that's an argument opposed by traditional liberals and by traditional conservatives as well. But that's the neoconservative approach. Trump is opposing that, and so I think he's saying, in one sense, if there's an issue that can be handled militarily, get in there, deal with it, and then get out and let those folks deal with the wreckage. The wreckage is not our responsibility.
Okay. What about the defense budget, also in light of this James Mattis nomination to be Secretary of Defense? Now, don't we have to keep in mind that now we have a unified Republican government, and Donald Trump having plans for hundreds of billions of dollars in new defense spending. The Democrats don't have any power here?
Well, they can filibuster in the Senate because the Republicans don't have a filibuster-proof majority. But they don't have 60 votes, 60 seats. But there's some complications there, political and otherwise. But, you know, both parties, we typically hear the statement that Republicans are cautious about spending money and Democrats want to spend money right and left. Both parties love to spend money. They just differ on what they want to spend it on. Democrats tend to want to spend it domestically. Republicans want to spend it on defense and the military and things like that. And so the Trump plans will bump up, or at least it will make Republicans bump up against their concern for cutting back on the deficit, which is the in every given year, it's when government spends more than it takes in, as opposed to the debt, which is the accumulated deficits over the years. Republicans want to cut down on the deficit. They talk about how vital it is to do that and how much of the deficit and especially the debt are a threat to the American way of life. But they also support big spending on the military. So when the rubber meets the road, or between that rock and a hard place, what are they going to do? And we don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. On Tuesday, President-elect Trump called for the U.S. government to cancel their contract with Boeing to build two new presidential planes. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Well, the plane is totally out of control. It's going to be over $4 billion. It's for Air Force One program. And I think it's ridiculous. I think Boeing is doing a little bit of a number. We want Boeing to make a lot of money, but not that much money. Okay, thank you.
Perked up ears, not only at Boeing, but in corporate America. I think you'll agree, Dennis, today on NBC's morning program with host Matt Lauer, he explained a little bit more about this episode. He said, well, I think the planes are too expensive. I spoke to a terrific guy yesterday, said President-elect Trump, the head of Boeing, and I think we're going to work it out. But, you know, that's what I'm here for. I'm going to negotiate prices. So what are your thoughts on this attack out of the blue on Boeing? Is this just the way Donald Trump conducts business, also as president?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way he's always worked. That's been his career as a businessman, very transactional. I'll do this for you if you do that for me, and I'll be willing to pay this but not that, and so forth. The question is whether he sees the entire presidency in those terms. When he talked about our alliances and saying, well, we're going to defend them only if they pay up, you know, our alliances like NATO aren't a protection racket. And they're not a business partnership or transaction. There's something more fundamental about Western values and Western concerns and Western vulnerabilities there. But he seemed to suggest or see things purely in transactional business terms, pay up or we don't perform. And I think that in this particular case, again, this is, you know, when you talk about a couple trillion-dollar government budget, wherever it happens to be now, you know, it, long-term, yeah, the two Air Force Ones may well be $4 billion, and there is a history of cost overruns at the Pentagon, and Senator Grassley has always been a watchdog in that regard. Remember his focus years ago on so-called $400 toilet seats?
Yes.
So that's always a concern, but I think in this particular case, this is more of a symbolic statement. In other words, trying just like the carrier jobs deal, trying to show his supporters that I'm going to cut back on business as usual, and we're going to turn things around. We're going to stop wasting money, and we're going to stop outsourcing jobs. So I see this more as a symbolic statement rather than anything significant in policy terms.
Dennis Goldford, tell us what else you have on your mind as this Trump cabinet gets put together. Just a few minutes ago, we saw John Kelly, another retired Marine general, is Trump's choice to lead the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, again, there's that issue of all these retired military in the cabinets. And, you know, Trump's military experiences was a few years in military school. But remember, he rather audaciously said, I know more about ISIS than all the generals. And that appalled a number of people, not just on the Democratic side of the ledger. It appalled a lot of Republicans. So, again, that comes back to one of the first things I said in this half hour, which is who's whispering in his ear? Who will he be taking advice from? But more broadly, he just is assembling a team, and will they be able to help him see certain matters, or will they be able to tell him at times, Mr. President, you're wrong, if Mattis did say, no, sir, waterboarding doesn't work. But a president needs to have a team, both in the White House staff and among cabinet members, and this is any president, any party, who are willing to say at times, Mr. President, you're wrong, or you can't do that. And to keep the president out of trouble. That's the first job of any staffer, and is to keep the president out of trouble. Again, president of any party, any era. And so are these folks likely to do that, or are they going to simply say, yes, sir, salute, and move on?
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump still apparently mulling over who should serve as our country's top diplomat, Secretary of State. Names having been mentioned, Rudolph Giuliani, David Petraeus, Senator Bob Corker, also most prominently Mitt Romney, one of his harsh adversaries over the past few years.
Well, we don't know if Trump is doing this to humiliate Romney, to set him up and then cut his legs out from under him. We don't know if that's the case, number one. Number two, a Secretary of State has a meaningful role only to the extent to which the president allots him or her that role. And the classic case was goes back to China, well before Governor Branstad, when the great opening to China, when Nixon and Henry Kissinger in the late 60s had all these secret negotiations that eventually led to recognition Kissinger used to travel there secretly. Nobody but Nixon and maybe Nixon's White House staff, his closest advisors, knew that Kissinger was going there. And Nixon's Secretary of State at the time was a guy named William P. Rogers. He was the Secretary of the State. He was the last person that knew what was going on. He had not a clue. So the question is, how does a given president use a Secretary of State? As a trusted advisor and troubleshooter, or the Secretary of State talks to the ambassadors and visits countries, but the real action is through the National Security Council? We don't know yet how Trump would use this.
Before we say goodbye for this week, Dennis, in a minute or two, give us your reading on the continued questions of conflict of interest due to Trump's worldwide business holdings. Now, we heard that his transition spokesman, Jason Miller, says that Trump sold all of his holdings in the stock market over the summer. I guess that could remove some, but certainly not all of the potential conflicts of interest of this billionaire businessman before he takes office. How do you see this conflict of interest question being handled in the weeks to come or thus far?
Well, Democrats have called attention to it, and the question is the degree to which Republicans will take it as something seriously. If you're in the Congress, you have two sets of loyalties. One is institutional loyalties. As you're a senator, you want to maintain the importance, authority, and powers of the Senate. Same if you're in the House. But you also have partisan loyalties. So if you're a Republican, you're loyal to a Republican president, Democrat to a Democratic president, and if you're opposite, you oppose. So will the Republicans, whether it's cabinet appointments or potential conflicts of interest, will they say, yes, sir, we want to support you, but this is not good for you or not good for the country, therefore we can't give you our advice and consent in this regard, or at least our consent? Or will they say, yes, sir, you're a Republican, we support you, we'll do whatever you want? This remains to be seen as well.
Okay, Dennis Goldford, thank you for joining us again on this Politics Wednesday. Professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Drake University, Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute of Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Dennis Goldford, such a pleasure always to have you on the program. Thanks for your insights this time.
Good to talk to you, Ben.
All right. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.